Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Tech giants Google and Apple are known for creating sleek, compact gadgets that integrate into our daily lives. Google is now setting its sights on one of the largest machines in our daily lives. Last Wednesday, Google announced Android Auto. It's a new interface that links your Android smartphone to your car. Antoine Goodwin has written about this for Car Tech at CNET Networks. He joins us by phone. Hi, Antoine.
Good morning.
So Google recently announced Android Auto. What is Android Auto?
So what Android Auto is an extension of the Android operating system that you'll find on Android handsets, the phones. And what it does is when you connect a compatible version of the Android phone, this is the new generation of Android that's going to be coming out later on this year, to a car that supports Android Auto, it will present the driver with a car-specific interface in the dashboard where you normally see, for example, the OEM's navigation system that will give them access to the navigation and music and telephony features that you'll already find on your phone right there in the dashboard in a very safe way.
Are other phone producers making similar systems?
Well, Google is pretty much handling everything Android-related on that on its end, and that's going to cover Samsung, LG, HTC for the next generation of Android phones. On the other side of the equation, we've got Apple, which has its iOS CarPlay, which is a very similar feature that was debuted much earlier this year. And it's going to do a similar thing for iPhone users, basically giving them a specific version of Apple's interface that's going to give them access to navigation, maps, voice command, and whatnot.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Antoine Goodwin. He is with CNET, CarTech, and GPS. He has written about the Android Auto for CarTech there. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So can I buy the interface system for a car I already have, or is it just for certain new cars?
Well, Google has 40 automakers lined up, and Apple has about the same number. And you won't be seeing it in a brand new car until probably the 2015 model year, which will be getting here. The 2016 model year, which will be getting here in the year 2015. So it'll be a while down the road before you can buy this in a brand new car. But if you want to add it onto a car that you already own, there will be aftermarket applications from companies like Pioneer or Alpine that'll be available next year.
And how do the controls work? Can you just kind of visualize it for us?
Right. So what it does is it presents you with a car-specific interface on your touchscreen. So you've got your large 7 or 8 inch touchscreen in your dashboard, and along the bottom you're going to have very simple controls, a shortcut for navigation, a shortcut for your phone, and a shortcut to your music. And everything, the maps interface will be presented with large buttons and a big emphasis on voice command. One of Google's big features is its Google Now voice command and Google Voice Search. So the idea is that with an Android Auto equipped car, you'll be able to hit a button on your steering wheel and say, navigate to the nearest ice cream parlor, or call Susie, or send John a text message that says this, as opposed to fiddling with the interface on your phone or even pushing buttons on the dashboard. They want it to be very simple for the driver to use, not a lot of clutter on the screen, and more of an emphasis on you keeping your eyes on the road and letting your mouth do all the work.
So the idea is there's a safety component here then.
That's the whole point of this, is to basically control what you can and can't do in the car, and to give drivers an incentive to put their phone down. Right now, the cat's out of the bag as far as distracted driving goes, and it's really hard to convince people to not answer phone calls or to not use their phone for navigation. But if you can give them a compelling and easy-to-use alternative, they're probably going to be more likely to plug their phone up to the car system and tuck it away. That way they can't be distracted by things like Facebook, but they still get access to their favorite audio streaming apps, and also to be able to get text messages via voice and to send text messages without seeing any text on a screen or taking your eyes off the road.
Making apps for a car is something software developers probably aren't accustomed to? Do you see third-party app producers working with this system or what?
Well, there have been third-party applications in the car for about 2 or 3 years now.
Okay.
One of the most commonly known ones is Pandora. You can get that in a lot of different cars right now to get your internet radio. And there are a couple of other things. For example, Ford's Sync system has a couple of dozen apps that you can get in your car. But the problem with those systems is that now it's in the automaker's hand to certify which apps can and can't be used in the car. And with different municipalities, different international laws being tricky as far as what you can and can't do and what interfaces you can use and how big the text needs to be, there's not a lot of incentive for A, the manufacturers to put the effort into certifying these apps, and B, for the app manufacturers, the app developers, your internet radio apps, your podcast apps, your third-party navigation apps. There's not a lot of incentive for them to go through the extra mile to develop for the car either, because it's just a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But now what you've got CarPlay on Apple's side and Android Auto on the Google side of the equation, that takes all of that and simplifies it. So it makes it a lot easier to get the apps in the car without making a lot of work for the automakers or for the app developers. And that makes it easier for you, the consumer, to get access safely to the things that you need.
So if I forget my phone at home, like I do about once a week, and want to know, can I still use the smartphone system in the car?
Well, the interesting thing about these systems is that they don't live on the car. They live on your phone, mm-hmm. and they use your phone's data connection for all of the stuff that you'll need to do. So if you leave your phone at home, you won't be able to have access to your navigation or your apps because you're not installing them in the car. You're actually just gaining access to them from your phone. So even though the interface is mirrored on the car screen, it's not really a dumb display, but it's just a screen mm-hmm. that you connect your phone to.
All right. So will I be able to revert to the GPS directions and stuff that was already in the car when I got it?
Right. We've already seen Pioneer working with Apple on their CarPlay, and they've actually put the CarPlay functionality into their navigation receivers. So you can have maps that are stored locally on the device, or you can have maps that are stored on the phone. We've also seen a similar thing with Hyundai and their Apple CarPlay. So you can have the maps that come with your car in the dashboard, but if you want to gain access to things like the advanced voice search or web-connected features, or the if you just like the maps on your phone better, you'll be able to tap a button and switch over to that Android Auto or to switch over to the Apple CarPlay, depending on which phone you have, and gain access to that as well. So you're not getting rid of the old technology that's already in your car right now, but you're adding an extra layer onto that for more tech-savvy users.
So a new car is a bigger deal for most people than a new phone. If I buy a car with Android Auto and then 5 years later want to trade my phone, my Android phone, in for an iPhone, am I just stuck with a car system that isn't compatible with my phone, or can it be amended like you said?
Well, it's going to vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Right now, all of the automakers that I've spoken to, and I've spoken to Kia and Hyundai and Audi, they have different timelines for their implementation of CarPlay and Android Auto. So there may be some really early adopters who get, for example, a 2015 Kia Soul that has Android Auto in it, but then Kia doesn't integrate CarPlay until later in the game. So they may be stuck out. But it may also be as simple as going to your dealer and getting a firmware update. We don't actually know how this is going to play out. But in-car systems have been getting more and more modular and easier to update. And a lot of times it's just as simple as going to your dealer, having them plug a USB key in with a new firmware, updating your receiver for the software.
And finally, is this going to start something of a turf war between Apple and Google fighting over car makers? How is that going to work?
Well, the interesting thing is, like I said, Google has 40 car manufacturers lined up. Apple's got nearly as many. There's a lot of overlap there. So what we're going to see is automakers just putting both of them in the car and giving consumers a choice of what they want to use.
And you don't see Apple or Google saying, no, you have to have us exclusively?
Well, right now, it's a pretty big battle just to get this tech in the car. And the technologies are similar enough, I believe, in that they both just use a USB port. So it's really up to the automaker which technologies they want to put in there. And it's in their best interest to put both of them in there. I don't think Google or Apple really holds enough sway to convince, for example, General Motors not to.
I don't know. We shall see. In the meantime, Antoine Goodwin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Antoine Goodwin has written about Android Auto for CarTech at CNET Networks. We'll continue with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Have you ever been overwhelmed by the number of super happy or super sad status updates and stories on your Facebook news feed? That might not have been a coincidence. In January 2012, nearly 700,000 Facebook users unwittingly participated in a psychological experiment that altered their Facebook news feeds. Joining us now by phone is Associate Technology Editor at The Atlantic, Robinson Meyer. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What was the goal of the study?
So Facebook set out to see whether by determining, by sending a certain, more happy or sadder statuses to your news feed, the kind of central flow of stories you see when you open Facebook on your computer or phone, it could make you happy or sad in turn. And what it found is that though the effect is very small, it does seem to be there, that by surfacing more happier or more negative stories, people in turn post more happier or more negative, sadder status messages and things on Facebook themselves.
I remember a period when it seemed like every other post, if not every post, was somebody's dog dying. And could that have, I mean, it was a really pronounced period for me. And I thought, what is it, a plague out there? And I felt terrible. But I actually didn't use Facebook as much because of it.
That's interesting. You know, so if it happened, first of all, during January 2012,
right.
Maybe it was. And actually, if it happened after that, the anomalous thing about this study is that we know about it. So we know that this specific experiment was run on more than 500,000 users in, during that week. But we also know that Facebook does a lot of things like it. So even if it wasn't during January 2012, it might have been a similar effect. I think the funny thing, or the perhaps ironic thing that's come out is that Facebook, it looks like, began running the study for a PR reason, it now seems. Facebook, if you remember, like in 2012, there was this complaint in the popular press that Facebook, by looking at all your friends, like pictures of your friends going out and like having good meals on Instagram or going for a hike, you were at home and looking at your phone and lonely, and it would make you sadder. That basically, like, looking at happy things on Facebook would make you sadder. And so Facebook ran this experiment to see if, by showing people, overtly, unusually happy amounts of stuff or unusually sad amounts of stuff, it would then, have that effect on them. So the fact that you avoided using Facebook makes sense, kind of given what the study found, and also confirms this rebuttal that Facebook was trying to make at the time, that if you see happy things on Facebook, you want to, you generally feel happy about it. And if you see sad things on Facebook, you generally feel sad about it.
Well, I also wondered, why is there only a like, it's got to be kind of stupid. But all right, so what do we know about what they considered negative or positive?
Yeah, and that's a good question. So they use the text analysis tool. And this is where the methodology of the study starts getting fudgy, and in fact, where things I've already said, you know, can come up for question. They were looking for statuses that had a preponderance of positive words, statuses that had a preponderance of negative words. The thing is that, as you know, you can imagine, Facebook statuses are short. So analyzing them, doing this kind of very brute sentiment analysis on them, doesn't always return the statuses which are actually happy and actually sad. So, you know, I did not have a really wonderful, fantastic, amazing day today.
Mm-hmm.
With very brute sentiment analysis terms, that has a negative rating of like 1 and a positive rating of 3. So that seems to be, at a very brute, you know, computational level, mm-hmm. a positive status, but it's not. And then they did the same kind of analysis on users' feeds and on the things that users were typing into Facebook. So there's another question there of, you know, even if they got people to type happier or sadder statuses into Facebook, then the normal, were the people actually feeling happier or sadder, or were they just responding to the, you know, performance they saw their friends giving on Facebook? You know, they kind of participated in it themselves.
I like how you call it the performance that they saw their friends giving.
Yeah, I think that's the probably the, you know, that's kind of what Facebook is, you know? And so when we see, I was talking to a psychologist yesterday who was like, I would be really, you know, it's in Facebook's interest to not call it a performance. They want everything on Facebook to look real. But the psychologist was saying that it might be that people actually felt better about the happier, sadder statuses. And the sadder statuses, because if you look at your newsfeed and it seems like all your friends are sad, and then you post a sad status, then you might think, wow, like I'm like all my friends. Like I'm fitting in. And then you feel pretty good about fitting in.
This is not good. All right. So the study's been criticized for being unethical or even illegal. What are the merits to those two claims? Do people have a right to be angry about this?
I think they definitely do. You know, I think, first of all, it is an academic study. It's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a very prestigious American journal. And there are a lot of rules and norms governing what kind of things an academic study can do. And one of the biggest ones is if you have human subjects, that you secure their informed consent. So in, quote, language that is reasonably understandable, unquote, to the participants of the study, they would basically get to know that they're participating in a study. And then in a study like this one, which is deceptive, where you can't know exactly what you're studying while you're being studied, mm-hmm. the participants would then have another right to revoke the data they gave to the study, in case, having found out what they were getting researched for, they actually don't want, you know, information about them or just even their aggregated data point to be part of the scientific record. People in this study seem to have been given no such option. And while Facebook would claim that it can basically do whatever you want with your data according to the data use policy that you sign when you, you know, that you like agree to, it's 9,000 words when you sign onto the site.
I read every word of it, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. As did all of us, as did all of Facebook's billion users, right?
Right.
Facebook, the terms of service in effect in January 2012 didn't mention research as a thing that Facebook might do with your data. I think the study is, from what we know now, almost certainly unethical in academic research terms. I think we're still trying to figure out whether it's illegal in that, you know, how wide is the berth of things that Facebook can do with your data? Did it already have the right to conduct research experiments on you, even though it had not, you know, specifically reserved the right to conduct, quote, research on you in January 2012? That's still a question we're figuring out.
Yeah, I read this morning that they had actually changed the agreement 4 months after the study was done to include the word research.
Exactly. And the FCC was auditing them at the time for basically like running
running foul of their terms of service mm-hmm. already, like they were already being audited. So the timing of the study is very odd, and it is exactly right. It was not changed. The reservation of the right to do research on Facebook users, you know, wasn't even added to the terms of service until 4 months after the study was completed.
You know, so what institutions approved this study, and why did they decide that it was ethical if most people, if not everyone, was unaware of it, who was part of it?
It's a funny question. What it looks like now was that Facebook ran the study internally, kind of on its own recognizance. There's a researcher there who's one of the a employee researcher there who's a co-author of the study, Adam Kramer, and the study was run at least by him. And then, according to the best accounts we have now, two other academic researchers were brought in, one from Cornell, one from the University of California, and they only saw the results and then analyzed it. Now, if you're doing research at the University of California or Cornell, there are, you know, independent research boards kind of in the university that independently vet any research that involves human subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Cornell's, they're called IRBs, institutional review boards. Cornell's IRB determined that it didn't need to vet the results analysis because the experiment had already been conducted. So any harm, as long as the confidentiality of the data was guaranteed, any harm to human subjects had passed because the experiment had been run. And so therefore, Cornell's researcher was free to analyze the data. Now, it was published by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which has rules that IRBs must vet any experiment on human subjects. That now, it was accepted because Cornell's, it seems like the editor of that journal, the editor who accepted the paper, had been told that Cornell's IRB just decided it didn't need approval over the study. You know, over the experiment, but mm-hmm. that's because of the timing. That's because of, like, the experiment was conducted and then Cornell's IRB got involved. So there's a question about, first of all, can that odd set of, like, loopholes happen? Can you run an experiment on human subjects using Facebook and then bring in academic researchers afterward, get all the imprimatur of scientific publishing, get published in this really, you know, prestigious mm-hmm. journal because
damage done.
Company, exactly, because it was done. The other thing is that the paper, and this is something we're reporting on and don't really have answers for, the paper reports that the two academic researchers were involved in preliminary discussions. So it would be odd if, you know, these academic researchers could advise how you might describe how you might run an experiment like this. Facebook then would run the experiment internally so that it didn't need IRB approval. Mm-hmm. And then having run the experiment, you know, the deed's done, and then they can go publish academically because the IRB isn't involved because no human subjects can be protected anymore. So the whole ethical situation is very murky, and it has some you know, academics already. There's a law professor at the University of Maryland saying that the National Academy of Sciences should retract the paper because the theory under which it accepted it and the theory under which it said the paper was ethical has been disproven by the story of timing that we now have.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. I'm talking with Robinson Meyer, an associate technology editor at The Atlantic, about the recently revealed Facebook experiment on Facebook users. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I sense a slippery slope here that goes beyond Facebook.
Exactly. Something that I think is interesting is that we consent to a lot of this this research that happens. You know, that basically any big technology company like that has our data runs research on us all the time. But I think it shows us things like two different designs on the page, and then whichever one we kind of engage with more,
mm-hmm.
That it then selects that one. I think the difference is that when we talk about, you know, businesses doing research on their own people, you know, like on their customers, we kind of expect it to be along two axes, right? Like, we expect it to be either to improve the product for both of us. Like, I expect Facebook to run some degree of different algorithmic tests on my newsfeed, because all to the eventual end of showing me a better newsfeed, like showing me content that's more relevant to me, or to sell me things, like to keep me on Facebook longer. I think showing people things to see if to see if the company could make you sad, it's not outside of Facebook's power. You know, like, Facebook is permitted to do that under its own rules of what it can do to its customers. But it does break the pact, which I feel like Facebook users have with Facebook, that Facebook will test on us, but to make a better product or to sell things, and that we as consumers know that we should be vigilant about not throwing our money away and, you know, nor our time, but that Facebook's experiments aren't going to be, you know, overly callous. And I think the question is this one callous? And then also, what in the rest of our digital lives is being done to us that we're not aware of, that we will never see in a published study, and that we never consent to?
This study took place in 2012. We mentioned that they changed their user agreement about 4 months later to include the word research. Has Facebook become more or less transparent in what it tells us about its doing since then?
I would say Facebook, if anything, I was not covering it quite as closely in 2012 as I am now.
Mm-hmm.
But even I would say that Facebook's lack of transparency is something you can rely on. So the Facebook we know does a lot of stuff too, runs a lot of tests on our feed. This one, I think, is anomalous in that, you know, this incident is anomalous in that it happened as part of a study, and therefore we get to see it. But Facebook isn't really any more transparent now than it was then. And of course, now it has 2 more years of data. It has 2 more years of advances in, you know, computational statistics and data analysis. And so I think we can assume that the things it does with our data is more complex and less understood by us out here than it was even in 2012.
So given this latest criticisms in the past, are these kinds of controversies taking their toll on the company, or is Facebook bigger than ever?
I'm obliged to say that Facebook stock price has not been affected.
Okay.
However, I think there's a lot of people reading the stories on our site and on mm-hmm. other sites. And I think there is a lot of casual user interest in the story because this is not the least wishy-washy of arguments, but I think because it does violate this understanding that users have with Facebook. I think that it will erode the trust users put in Facebook, because I think it is an experiment that people don't expect Facebook to be running. It's so beyond the pale of things that people expect Facebook to be doing that people will think about it, you know, and even if it isn't something that causes an immediate mass exodus away from Facebook,
mm-hmm.
like, I don't think that's how Facebook will change. I think, you know, much like how it's hard to talk about a lot of these digital tech companies without talking about the NSA, so that you just have the NSA in the back of your head when you when you talk about these things. It's hard. It will be harder not to talk about Facebook without having experiments like this kind of looming in the background, or, you know, as a side joke.
Well, then I guess we'll keep talking with you, Robinson Meyer, about that.
Yeah, and I think I'm, you know, I'm so interested to see where the story goes. It feels like something that the privacy angle, digital privacy, is something I think a lot of people are concerned about and feel alternately scared when there's big breaches, and also just kind of hopeless about, because it's not something we have a lot of avenues on. And I hope that if anything, the story gets people to keep paying attention somewhat, and also to know that although it's not, you know, a question that our country has chosen to deal with politically yet, that's not something that's beyond the pale. That's, you know, regulating what Facebook can do with our data is an option. And so will that happen this year? Will it happen in five? I don't know, but it could, you know?
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Robinson Meyer is an associate technology editor at The Atlantic. Coming up, Russell Holly with Geek.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Tech types gathered last week for Google's annual developer conference, I/O, where Google executives revealed everything from TVs to virtual reality technology. Here to talk about what the future holds for Google products and services is tech blogger for Geek.com, Russell Holly. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, thank you.
So there's the cardboard virtual reality technology. What is that, and is it really even technology?
Well, yes, it is. It's a combination of a couple of really basic things that kind of come together to do something pretty cool. It was almost a joke at the end of the conference. Sundar Pichai stood up and said that as everyone is walking out of the press conference, there's going to be a piece of cardboard that's going to be handed to you, and you follow the instructions on it, and you'll have this really neat thing to try out. And in fact, it was this little cardboard thing that folded up into a box that had a pair of lenses on the inside of it. And the idea was you stuck your phone inside this cardboard box, and there was a special tag on the inside of the box that would install an app on your phone that gave you this kind of 3D virtual experience when looking at things like Google Maps and a couple other really basic applications. But what it did for developers was present this idea that virtual reality can be, instead of this big expensive thing through the, you know, $400 Oculus Rift or however expensive the Project Morpheus service is going to be, that there are ways to make this technology disposable as well, which opens a couple of interesting doors.
Like what?
Well, there was actually a developer company on Google Plus yesterday, goes by the name of BrickSimple, the name of the company. And one of the ideas that they proposed was real estate companies who are helping someone buy a home could actually load homes onto this cardboard device and send it to someone. And you could put your phone in this cardboard device and actually do virtual walkthroughs, three-dimensional virtual walkthroughs of the home without ever leaving your desk. You could do it all from where you are. So before you even go and do a house tour, you could get this kind of interactive walkthrough experience. And you know, when you were done with it, you could very easily either throw it away or use it for something else.
Couldn't you just get that over your computer? But I guess it wouldn't be 3D, right?
Right. It's the addition of that kind of immersive experience, where as soon as you press the lenses to your face, your eyes don't see anything else. And when you, because you're using your phone, when you turn your head, the images on the phone will turn with you. So it gives that more immersive experience. You can do, I mean, virtual house tours have been a thing on websites for a long time now, but this takes it kind of that next step further.
Now, have you speculated about where this technology could take us?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of virtual reality things that are being worked on right now. And it ends up being however clever, you know, the manufacturer feels like they can be as far as delivering that information. But I mean, games are definitely a big part of how this technology can move forward, especially as we're looking at just how inexpensive it would be. You know, you could include it with a DVD, you know, for a movie that came out, and it could be, you know, kind of a short game that came with that movie that came out, you know, for maybe, you know, the next Captain America or something like that. And even further than that, things like star maps, you know, at night, where you could go and kind of press it to your face and look up and gain, you know, kind of better idea of where star maps are.
What's the cost associated? So they gave you this cardboard to work with. What did that cost?
Well, it didn't cost the people who attended. I mean, obviously, the cost of attending was associated. But you can actually, there are a couple of companies now who have put together kits that the rest of us can buy, and they're $20. You can even build one for yourself for less if you know, feel like going through the process of kind of cutting out the intricate shapes and mounting the lenses that come with it. But it, you know, they're $20 from a couple of different companies that they give you this same kind of inexpensive virtual experience. It's very kind of silly and definitely still kind of a toy right now. But the idea of that technology going from being $400 down to something that you could throw away without really thinking about it is a really interesting step forward. You know, and at the same time, a step away from the kind of silly red and blue 3D glasses, because it's not really that experience. It's definitely a lot more, you know, interactive and you know, you really do get the sense that you are standing in this other place.
So you've tried it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's definitely interesting, especially for Google Maps, because so much of Google Maps right now has this three-dimensional photosphere that you can kind of look around in. And that's one of the big things that they demonstrated there, was being able to take that three-dimensional sphere and really, you know, bring it up to your face.
The virtual reality system itself was pretty simple, as you said, but is developing for it simple? Developing the apps?
It is not going to be simple.
Okay.
What you're basically doing on the screen, it gets kind of technical, because you're technically drawing two images at once with like a split going down the middle of the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were looking at the screen of the app without the piece of cardboard, you have this weird kind of distorted pair of images on the phone. It looks worse, in my opinion, than if you were to sit in a 3D movie without 3D glasses on.
Oh, okay.
It's two completely separate images instead of the two kind of laying over top of one another, because it's, you know, it's playing on the idea that it needs both of your eyes to draw the image. But when you have it through these lenses, which, you know, they're just, you know, simple magnifying lenses, and it just takes it and creates a single image in your eye. So the challenge for developers is creating an experience that is consistent, but also has to kind of be drawn twice every single frame. In a way, it has to be drawn twice.
So the downside, that it's essentially made out of cardboard. Will I have a better virtual reality experience with a more expensive device, something fancier than just cardboard?
Oh, yeah. This is designed for really kind of temporary experiences. You're only going to use this for a couple of minutes at a time, and then you're going to set it down until, you know, something else comes along. The systems that we're seeing from companies like Oculus Rift and what Sony's doing with Project Morpheus, these are incredibly high-end, you know, 1080p displays that are right next to your eye that are going to deliver, you know, just really phenomenal visual experiences. Whereas what you're getting from these cardboard devices is whatever your phone can generate. And while our phones can do a ton of stuff right now, there's still a pretty wide gap between what your phone is capable of and what a computer or a game console is capable of.
Okay. Moving on to TV, Android TV. The Android TV has not been released yet, but what have we seen of it so far?
So basically, Google is trying again. They've tried a couple of different times now to put something in the living room for people to enjoy their content, as well as Netflix and Hulu Plus and all of those services. And most of them have been unsuccessful. The closest to a truly successful product so far has been their Chromecast, their inexpensive $35 HDMI stick that can be plugged into the back of the television. And the easiest way to describe Android TV as it exists right now in this kind of developer box that they handed out at Google I.O. is a more advanced Chromecast that allows you to, stream higher quality video, access, more kinds of content, and a controller that gives you access to the video games that you would normally be playing on your phone. You can now play in a higher resolution version on your television.
How is it similar or different from, say, Amazon Fire TV?
They are remarkably similar to Amazon Fire TV. And the only real difference is the kind of content that you'll find on both. Amazon's content is exclusive to the Fire TV, compared to most of these things. And Google's not going to have Amazon's content. Amazon's not going to have Google's content. And in the same token, neither one of them have Apple's content. So we've got this kind of three-horse race in a strange way. And that's not counting things that Microsoft is doing with the Xbox and a couple other. There are a lot of people trying to get you to plug things into your television right now. just a lot of different companies. I should say companies, not people, trying to get you to plug things into your television right now. It's really interesting to see, how far that goes, because what a lot of these companies really want is the information that they gain from you watching this content and how you interact with your television. So how often you play video games, what kind of television you watch, all of that information is really interesting to Google because it allows them to, acquire more content in specific areas, try and, advertise in those particular categories. But as far as this device goes, they haven't announced pricing or anything. This is something that we're not going to see on shelves until the fall. Mm-hmm. But it is essentially Google's version of the Amazon Fire TV.
And do you see one of them doing better than the other, or the fact that their content doesn't overlap make a difference?
Their content overlaps in some ways. Netflix doesn't have an entire library of exclusive content. The next episode of Game of Thrones is going to be on Apple, Google, and Amazon. They're all going to have them. Either through HBO's app or through some kind of partnership. But, so a lot of it ends up being just the services that you're already buying stuff from. For example, I have a ton of movies that I've already purchased through Amazon, so I'm more likely to use Amazon services. But if you've been using, your iPhone or your iPad to buy a bunch of content, then, you're more likely to pick up an Apple TV. And the same goes for the Google Play Store. If you've purchased a bunch of movies and TV shows there, then you're more likely to want that option.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Russell Holly of Geek.com right now. If you have a question or comment, got about 3 minutes to take some calls, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the controller for the Android TV is not a regular remote, whatever that is, but it looks more like a classic video game controller. I think the winged version, I guess. What is the benefit of that layout, and could it alienate old people like me?
I think it definitely could alienate old people because you have to understand, Google's Chromecast service was entirely driven by your phone. So you plug the Chromecast into your television. There's no remote control. There's no buttons on the Chromecast itself. You plug it into your television and you do everything else from either your smartphone or your tablet. And that's how everything is done. Volume control, everything is done from the phone. You don't use a remote control at all. This, because there's a gaming element to it and because there's a desire to have a physical controller, this particular version is using just a regular gamepad, but Google went so far during their testing on stage to show that you could even just use a smartwatch to control every single aspect of the interface. All it really needs is that up, down, left, right, and enter to control the entire user interface. So it is definitely possible that unless some of Google's partners step in and say, you know, here's a very simple remote to control things, which is what Amazon did with the Fire TV, that could very well be an issue for older audiences moving forward.
And because people without these gadgets aren't going to want it, or that they're not going to, they just are going to be alienated by them in general.
I think that there's a lot to be said for that comfort zone when it comes to using your television. You expect that there's going to be a remote control. You expect that that there's going to be certain, you know, kinds of basic input for when things go wrong. And in my case, as embarrassing as it may be, sometimes when my phone has died, and you know, I can't, you know, the television show has ended, and my kids are looking at me going, "Dad, can we watch the next episode of that show?" And My phone is currently in pieces on the floor because I've decided to do something, and so there's no other way to control the television. You know, there are obstacles, and some of them may be, you know, larger first world problems than others in my case, but there is definitely something to be said for the more traditional control factor being, at the very least, a fallback option.
And something to fight over.
Absolutely something to fight over.
Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for letting me take the call, or taking my call.
You bet.
And I got a question for Russell. Who is it that's going to stand at the top of the hill as far as all the transmission capability infrastructure that's going to be needed to do all this? We've got, we've gone from 1G, I guess, up to 3G to 4G, to now we've got 3D and all 4G and all this stuff. Who's going to be on top of that as far as being able to install the infrastructure that can handle that kind of transmission?
Well, I honestly think that is that's not something that we have a definitive answer to yet. I think that in a couple of ways, the United States lags behind a little bit as far as what our wired and wireless infrastructures are capable of. And as we move into things like 4K content being broadcast over things like Netflix, that there's going to be an increased desire in answering that exact question, who's going to be able to provide the infrastructure to deliver that content. But I don't think that we have one solid answer right now. I know that there are markets where Verizon Fios is certainly capable. I know that Google's fiber optic service in the few towns that it lives in is more than capable of delivering that kind of content. But there's really no clear winner right now, because as has been the case for many years now, we have this weird gap between the quality of service and where that service is available. Verizon doesn't really compete in the same markets that Time Warner competes in. And so we end up having this kind of scattered map of services where no one is really the winner. But hopefully that changes soon, within the next 5 years, I would think.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Real quick, we just have about a minute left, Russell, but you wanted to talk about the PS4, PlayStation 4?
Yeah, specifically Destiny. Destiny is a game that is being made by the guys who originally made the Halo game.
Oh, yeah.
And they are they've announced a ton of exclusive content for the game, so when the game comes out, you're going to be able to do more on the PlayStation 4 version than you are on the Xbox version. And those exclusive, you know, kind of game content, whether it's like extra levels and stuff that you'll be able to do, will actually be a part of the PlayStation 4 for an entire year. So if you're interested in Destiny and you really are going to want to play this game that Bungie has been working on, it really looks like the PlayStation 4 is the best way to go for that.
Okay. Well, Russell Holly, as always, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks as well to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trainin, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.